contacts with al-Qaeda representatives. In exchange for money and assistance fighting against local rivals, tribal leaders agree to work with al-Qaeda by providing its fighters with arms, shelter, food, and 100 young tribesmen who can serve as local guides, bodyguards, and soldiers, assisting with al-Qaeda's Yemen-based military and terrorist activities as needed. Most people would agree that the tribal leaders and the 100 young tribesmen are now co-belligerents with al-Qaeda under the international law of war and could be detained and targeted by U.S. forces. But here's a harder one. Say Boko Haram fighters in Nigeria decide to model their organizational structure and training programs on those of al-Qaeda and initiate limited communication with al-Qaeda members. Boko Haram's exclusive focus is attacks against Nigerian Christians and Nigerian government interests inside Nigeria's borders. But Boko Haram leaders frequently express their view that they, like al-Qaeda, are part of a global Islamic jihad. As a courtesy, the two groups occasionally share information, but they do not coordinate their activities or act within the same geographic region. Can Boko Haram be said to be associated forces of al-Qaeda? Or say a group of Pakistani tribal leaders plans a series of attacks against Pakistani military targets. Their activities have a purely local focus. They have no interest in global jihad, but simply want the Pakistani military out of their territory. To that end, they occasionally coordinate their efforts with those of the Pakistani Taliban, who also want to target the Pakistani military. These same Pakistani Taliban leaders also sometimes move across the Afghan border and help Afghan-based Taliban fighters in operations against the Afghan military. Are the Pakistani tribal leaders co-belligerents of the Afghan Taliban? Add in more complexity, and it only gets more difficult. Is an Iraqi teenager who sends out social media messages on behalf of al-Qaeda a member of al-Qaeda? What about a Saudi financier who knowingly donates large amounts of money to an al-Qaeda-linked charity? Is there a difference between being a member of al-Qaeda and an al-Qaeda agent or operative? Can either the Iraqi teen or the Saudi financier be considered, if not an al-Qaeda member or agent or operative, a co-belligerent? Terms such as co-belligerent and combatant add clarity only when we think of war in 19th-century terms. And if anything, it has only grown more difficult to define our enemies since 9/11. Al-Qaeda Central has largely collapsed, but it has spawned numerous other networks and movements, loosely knit, non-hierarchical, geographically dispersed, and diverse in size, structure, methods, and aims. As former Defense Intelligence Agency Director Lieutenant General Michael Flynn recently put it, in 2004, there were 21 total Islamic terrorist groups spread out in 18 countries. Today, there are 41 Islamic terrorist groups spread out in 24 countries. These groups range from ISIS, which controls substantial parts of Syria and Iraq and has more than 40 affiliates around the world, to Nigeria's Boko Haram, Mali's Al-Mourabitoun, Tunisia's Ansar al-Sharia, and numerous others. Given this, it is hardly surprising that recent U.S. drone strikes have reportedly killed numerous individuals whose activities and affiliations are literally unknown. Although President Obama has frequently asserted that the United States only targets specific senior operational leaders of al-Qaeda and associated forces involved in the September 11, 2001 terror attacks who are plotting imminent violent attacks on Americans, classified CIA reports obtained by news outlets reportedly state that more than half of those killed by drone strikes in Pakistan in the year preceding September 2011 were not senior al-Qaeda leaders, but instead were assessed as Afghan, Pakistani, and unknown extremists. Similarly, 43 of 95 drone strikes reviewed for that period hit groups other than al-Qaeda, including the Haqqani Network, several Pakistani Taliban factions, and the unidentified individuals described only as foreign fighters and other militants. There is also no apparent means of ending the war against al-Qaeda and its associates. In a November 2012 speech, Defense Department General Counsel Jay Johnson raised this question. Now that efforts by the U.S. military against al-Qaeda are in their 12th year, we must also ask ourselves, how will this conflict end? That was several years ago, and the answer is even less clear today. For the Obama administration, this question clearly causes substantial unease. This war, like all wars, must end, President Obama told a National Defense University audience in May 2013. That's what our democracy demands. He repeated the sentiment in 2015. I do not believe America's interests are served by endless war. But how do we end a non-territorial armed conflict against an ill-defined, amorphous, protean enemy with no leaders authorized to speak on its behalf, no set membership, and only the vaguest of goals? The precedents we set. I'm convinced that my former colleagues in the military, the Department of Defense, and the intelligence community are good people acting in good faith. Despite my rule of law concerns, I trust them to act carefully and responsibly, doing their best to avoid mistakes and not abuse their power. But there are a lot of other people in the world I don't trust at all. And when the United States asserts a unilateral right to use force in secret and with little accountability outside the executive branch, we are essentially handing every repressive and unscrupulous regime in the world a playbook for how to violate sovereignty and literally get away with murder. Recall the 1976 murder of Orlando Letelier and the murder of Alexander Litvinenko 30 years later. Imagine how the United States would respond if Russia, or China, or Iran, or North Korea decided to engage in an expanded drone strike campaign against political critics living beyond their borders. Say it was Vladimir Putin's Russia, and say Russian strikes in various European countries had by now killed hundreds of people, or even several thousand. U.S. authorities would protest, of course, and insist on the importance of free expression, due process, and human rights. But Putin would presumably respond by taking a page from America's playbook. He would refuse to confirm or deny any Russian strikes, while insisting that any Russian strikes that might or might not have occurred complied with all applicable laws, and that any targeted persons were terrorists posing an imminent threat to Russian national security. The United States would naturally ask to see some evidence of this, but once again, Putin could simply echo the United States. Sorry, that's classified. And what could we say? Let's not kid ourselves. The legal arguments that the United States is now making will come back and bite us in the future. Putin himself has promised as much. In 2008, when the United States recognized Kosovo's unilateral declaration of independence from Serbia, Putin was furious. The UN had promised to respect Serbia's sovereign integrity. Putin argued that the U.S. decision to disregard what Russia saw as Serbia's right to sovereignty threatened to blow apart the whole system of international relations. The United States and other states opting to recognize Kosovar independence should understand that their decision was a two-sided stick, warned Putin, and the second end will come back and hit them in the face. That particular two-sided stick has already been deployed by the Russians in the context of Ukraine and Crimea, where Putin greeted U.S. protestations about the importance of respecting Ukrainian sovereignty with little more than a cynical smirk. In Syria, too, Putin has highlighted inconsistencies in U.S. actions and legal arguments. If the United States can use military force inside Syria without the consent of the Syrian government, why should Russia be condemned for using force inside Ukraine? The legal precedents we are setting risk undermining the fragile norms of sovereignty and human rights that help keep our world stable. We should ask ourselves this: do we want to live in a world in which every state considers itself to have a legal right to kill people in other states, secretly and with no public disclosure or due process, based on its own unilateral assertions of national security prerogatives? Chapter 18. War everywhere, law nowhere? The rule of law is one of those terms people toss around freely, but often without much effort to explain just what they mean. Here's the definition used by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The rule of law, he says, can be understood as a principle of governance in which all persons, institutions, and entities, public and private, including the state itself, are accountable to laws that are publicly promulgated, equally enforced, and independently adjudicated, and which are consistent with international human rights norms and standards. It requires, as well, measures to ensure adherence to the principles of supremacy of law, equality before the law, accountability to the law, fairness in the application of the law, separation of powers, participation in decision-making, legal certainty, avoidance of arbitrariness, and procedural and legal transparency. In the international sphere, the rule of law requires, at a bare minimum, the avoidance of arbitrariness and procedural and legal transparency. As legal scholar Simon Chesterman puts it, the law itself must be accessible and clear. This is essential for ensuring basic stability. If it is to have any value at all, international law must provide a reasonably clear basis for predicting state behavior and for holding states accountable when they break the law. Surprisingly enough, the international system generally works despite the lack of a global Supreme Court, a global legislature, or a global police force. The late Louis Henkin, one of America's most prominent international law experts, once observed, "Almost all nations observe almost all principles of international law and almost all of their obligations almost all of the time." States need each other, particularly given today's interconnected economies. Concerns about reputation, reciprocity, and retaliation give most states strong incentives to behave themselves. And when disagreements arise, most states are content to rely on diplomacy, arbitration, international and regional courts, and so on, to settle disputes. Not all states, of course. Occasionally, a state blatantly flouts international law. Iraq's 1990 invasion of Kuwait is one example. This led to the first Gulf War. Syria's use of chemical weapons is another example. But even the most egregious rule-breaking doesn't necessarily undermine the international rule of law any more than the continued existence of crime undermines the domestic rule of law. As long as serious rule-breaking is occasional rather than constant, and as long as most rule-breakers face consequences, the system itself can remain effective and intact. Ironically, uncertainty and ambiguity can undermine the rule of law far more than occasional, blatant rule-breaking. The rule of law is most fundamentally concerned with constraining and ordering power and violence, and this concern led states to develop detailed legal rules governing the use of armed force. But with no Supreme Court to deliver authoritative pronouncements on how to interpret the law, global peace and stability depends on the willingness of states to cooperate, to develop shared interpretations of legal rules and the concepts and terms on which the rules are premised. Shared state interpretations of rules, terms, and concepts doesn't preclude some degree of vagueness and ambiguity in international law. Up to a point, legal vagueness and ambiguity can even be useful, giving states face-saving ways to avoid conflict by looking the other way when confronted with challenging but not manifestly illegal behavior. But the introduction of excessive uncertainty wholly undermines the possibility of clarity, stability, predictability, and non-arbitrariness. When key international law concepts vital to the regulation of violence lose any fixed meaning, when, for instance, an exceptionally powerful state begins to interpret international law in a substantially different way than most other states, it becomes increasingly difficult to predict that state's behavior. And unpredictability can spread. One powerful outlier can pave the way for others, and as more states join the outlier, the foundations of the rule of law begin to crumble. U.S. counterterrorism practices and the legal theories that underpin them are undermining the international rule of law in precisely this way. Critics of U.S. counterterrorism practices often assert that targeted killings, indefinite detention, and NSA eavesdropping are blatantly illegal, but would be more accurate to say that many U.S. counterterrorism practices simply defy straightforward legal categorization. In fact, the legal reasoning behind them constitutes a sustained challenge to the generally accepted meaning of core legal concepts, including self-defense, armed attack, imminence, necessity, proportionality, combatant, civilian, armed conflict, and hostilities. The end result is increased uncertainty and unpredictability about both U.S. behavior and international legal rules, a dangerous state of affairs in a world that's already seeing rising tensions between great powers. To understand how U.S. counterterrorism practices are increasing global uncertainty and unpredictability, return once again to the issue of U.S. drone strikes outside of traditional battlefields. For political decision-makers, unmanned aerial vehicles have obvious advantages. They're cheap and precise, and their use creates no short-term risk to American lives. As it happens, drone technologies improved dramatically, just as the United States, struggling to respond to the threat of transnational terrorism after 9/11, began to perceive an increased need for low-cost, low-risk cross-border uses of force. Beginning in 2008, the United States began to make more frequent use of strikes from unmanned aerial vehicles. Most controversially, the United States has greatly increased its reliance on drone strikes outside of traditional, territorially bounded hot battlegrounds. Yet almost everything about U.S. drone strikes is shrouded in secrecy. For the most part, the government does not comment on or acknowledge reported drone strikes that take place outside of hot battlefields and does not release lists of those targeted or killed. Senior Obama administration officials have offered oblique accounts of the drone strike program, but these have been at an extremely high level of generality. As a result, it is impossible to describe current practices or internal procedures with any certainty, and also impossible to know exactly what legal constraints U.S. officials believe exist, and whether and how these have changed in the last few years. From speeches delivered by senior officials and government court filings, we do know that the United States believes itself to be in an armed conflict, as defined by international law, with al-Qaeda and its associates. We know the United States therefore considers al-Qaeda operatives to be targetable as combatants, but we don't know precisely how it identifies or defines al-Qaeda operatives, agents, or members, or how it defines the term combatants and applies it in the murky context of transnational terrorism. We also don't know precisely how the United States understands the term civilian in the context of terrorism, or the concept of direct participation in hostilities. Finally, we don't know how the United States defines or identifies associates or co-belligerents of al-Qaeda, although we know that the United States considers the Islamic State to be either a successor group to al-Qaeda or an associated force, despite the open enmity between the two organizations. Understanding U.S. legal arguments is made still more difficult by the fact that administration spokespersons often appear to oscillate between referencing the international law of armed conflict and referencing the law of self-defense when justifying drone strikes. When it comes to issues of sovereignty, U.S. officials have repeatedly stated that they only use force inside the borders of a sovereign state when that state either consents to the use of force or is unwilling and unable to take appropriate action to address the threat itself. We don't know, however, how the United States evaluates issues of consent in situations in which consent is ambiguous. In Pakistan, for instance, at least some elements of the executive branch gave tacit consent to U.S. drone strikes, even as they publicly denied it. But the legislative branches and judicial branches have both denied consent. We also don't know what criteria the United States uses to determine whether a state is unwilling or unable to take appropriate action, or what action would be deemed appropriate. Humpty Dumpty. That's a lot of unknowns. Nevertheless, if we piece together public statements by U.S. officials, court filings, leaked government documents, and the existing evidence about past strikes and their targets, the basic outlines of the United States legal theory underlying targeted killings become visible. While much remains uncertain, it is clear that recent statements and practices by the United States represent a substantial challenge to international legal rules on the use of armed force. The United Nations Charter prohibits the use of force by one state inside the borders of another sovereign state without that state's consent. The two big exceptions are Security Council authorization, cases in which the Security Council may respond to an act of aggression by taking action by air, sea, or land forces as may be necessary to maintain or restore international peace and security, and self-defense. The traditional understanding of the right to self-defense limits the unilateral use of force to situations in which a state is responding to a recent armed attack or to an imminent threat of future attack. But according to a leaked 2011 Justice Department memo, the most detailed legal justification that is publicly available, the United States is now taking a radically different approach to defining an imminent threat. According to the Justice Department memo, the requirement that force only be used to prevent an imminent threat does not require the United States to have clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons and interests will take place in the immediate future. This seems, and is, at odds with the traditional view, as well as with ordinary dictionary definitions of the word imminent. The Justice Department white paper goes on to assert that certain members of al-Qaeda are continually plotting attacks and would engage in such attacks regularly if they were able to do so, and the U.S. government may not be aware of all plots as they are developing and thus cannot be confident that none is about to occur. As a result, the white paper concludes that any person deemed to be an operational leader of al-Qaeda or its associated forces inherently presents an imminent threat at all times. And as a result, the United States can lawfully target such persons at all times, even in the absence of specific knowledge relating to planned future attacks. At the risk of belaboring the obvious, this understanding of imminence turns the traditional international law interpretation of the concept completely on its head. Instead of reading it to mean that states must have concrete knowledge or at least reasonable suspicion of an actual impending attack in the near future, the United States appears to construe lack of knowledge of a future attack as the justification for using force. That is, since the United States may not be aware of all plots and thus cannot be confident that none is about to occur, force is presumed always to be justified against the kinds of people considered likely to engage in attacks if they were able to do so. It's reminiscent of Humpty Dumpty's famous exchange with Alice in Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. "There's glory for you," said Humpty Dumpty. "I don't know what you mean by glory," Alice said. Humpty Dumpty smiled contemptuously. "Of course you don't, till I tell you. I meant there's a nice knockdown argument for you."
"But glory doesn't mean a nice knockdown argument," Alice objected.
"When I use a word," Humpty Dumpty said in rather a scornful tone, "it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less."
"The question is," said Alice, "whether you can make words mean so many different things."
"The question is," said Humpty Dumpty, "which is to be master? That's all."
From a rule of law perspective, the Justice Department white paper represents a radical assault on a once stable concept. If imminent threat can mean lack of evidence of the absence of imminent threat, it is impossible to know with any clarity the circumstances under which the United States will in fact decide that the use of military force is lawful. The rule of law conundrums don't end there. Under international law, the use of force in self-defense must also be consistent with the principles of necessity and proportionality. The principle of necessity tracks the ancient just war requirement that force should be used only as a last resort when measures short of force have proven ineffective, and the principle of proportionality relates to the amount and nature of the force used. But given the lack of transparency around U.S. drone strikes, it is impossible to say whether any given strike, or the totality of strikes, satisfies these legal and ethical principles. Are all U.S. drone strikes necessary? Could non-lethal means of combating terrorism, such as efforts to disrupt terrorist financing and communications, be sufficient to prevent future attacks? Might particular terror suspects be captured rather than killed? Do drone strikes inspire more terrorists than they kill? Also, to what degree does U.S. drone policy distinguish between terrorist threats of varying gravity? If drone strikes against a dozen targets prevented another attack on the scale of 9/11, few would dispute their appropriateness or legality. But we might judge differently a drone strike against someone unlikely to cause serious harm to the United States. But if U.S. decision makers lack specific knowledge about the nature and timing of future attacks, which the Justice Department white paper acknowledges, judgments of necessity and proportionality become impossible. There's no way to determine if lethal force is necessary to prevent a possible future attack about which one knows nothing, and no way to decide how much force is proportionate to preventing a possible future attack of unknown magnitude. Here again, the U.S. legal theory underlying targeted killing makes it impossible to apply key principles in a meaningful way. Both necessity and proportionality come to be evaluated in the context of hypothetical worst-case scenarios. In theory, any terror suspect might be about to unleash another catastrophic attack on the scale of 9/11. As a result, these limitations on the use of force establish no limits at all. The problem goes still deeper. Should drone strikes be construed legally as a series of discrete uses of force, each of which must be independently evaluated for adherence to self-defense principles? Or do they constitute
In effect, an ongoing use of force made up of many individual strikes, which should be evaluated collectively. If the latter, can the United States be said to be in an armed conflict with militants in Pakistan, suspected al-Qaeda associates in Yemen, members of the al-Shabaab organization in Somalia, and assorted other unknown groups and individuals? From a rule of law perspective, as we know, it is crucial that we be able to determine the existence or non-existence of an armed conflict. In an armed conflict, it's lawful to target enemy combatants based simply on their status as enemy soldiers. If there is no armed conflict, such status-based targeting is unlawful, and force may only be used to ward off an imminent threat. In a domestic context, disputes like this don't necessarily pose an ongoing challenge to the rule of law. Although significant legal vagueness and ambiguity might persist for a time, the courts might eventually resolve the uncertainty by selecting one interpretation over the others, or new legislation might be passed to resolve the uncertainties. In the international context, however, there is no referee able to make such vital calls. There is no judicial system and no legislature. States can enter into multilateral treaties, but there is no set procedure for creating such treaties. And in practice, treaties frequently take decades to be negotiated and further decades to enter into force. Furthermore, the structure of the Security Council makes it near impossible to imagine a Security Council-imposed resolution to any of these questions. Russia and China would likely block any U.S. effort to gain Council authorization for drone strikes or to create some international force empowered to engage in such strikes. At the same time, the United States would use its veto to block any Council criticism of its actions. At the moment, the United States itself, as the globe's only military superpower, is judge, jury, and executioner all rolled into one. With zero transparency, it decides how to interpret the law to which it is subject. It decides what can be counted as evidence and how to evaluate that evidence. And ultimately, it kills. The concept of sovereignty itself has also been further destabilized by post-9/11 U.S. legal theories. In recent decades, globalization has reduced the salience of state borders even as the emergence of human rights law has chipped away at the state's legitimacy. Nevertheless, the concept of sovereignty, however frayed and problematic, has long served as a bulwark against unpredictable international conflict. Recent U.S. pronouncements suggest that this will not remain true for much longer. It sounds superficially reasonable when U.S. officials assert that the United States will only use force on the territory of other sovereign states if that state either consents or is unwilling or unable to suppress the threat posed by the individual being targeted. But the logic is, in fact, circular, since the United States is the self-appointed arbiter of whether a state is unwilling or unable. Thus, if the United States, using its own malleable definition of imminent, decides that an individual in, say, Pakistan poses a threat to the United States and requires killing, sovereignty is a non-issue. Either Pakistan will consent to a U.S. strike inside its territory, or it will not consent. And if Pakistan does not consent, on the grounds perhaps that it does not agree with the U.S. threat assessment, then Pakistan is, ipso facto, unwilling or unable to suppress the threat posed by the individual being targeted. It's a legal theory that more or less eviscerates traditional notions of sovereignty and has the potential to significantly undermine the already shaky collective security regime created by the United Nations Charter. Remember the Duck Rabbit. U.S. drone strikes present not an issue of lawbreaking, but of law's brokenness. Sustained U.S. assaults on the meaning of core legal concepts have left international law on the use of armed force not merely vague or ambiguous, but effectively indeterminate, eroding law's value as a predictor of state conduct and a means of holding states accountable. But although the justifications for drone strikes proffered by the United States pose grave challenges to the international rule of law, it would be facile to condemn them out of hand. After all, though these strikes, or more accurately, the legal theories that underlie them, challenge the international rule of law, they also represent an effort on the part of the United States to respond to gaps and failures in the international system. The UN Security Council is paralyzed by anachronistic membership and voting rules, weakening arguments that the United States should wait for Security Council authorization before engaging in targeted strikes. Further, the United States is not wholly wrong to argue that traditional definitions of imminence are inadequate in the context of today's threats. And while it's easy to lambast circular U.S. arguments about sovereignty, here again the United States is not necessarily wrong to argue that when many lives may be at stake, legal principles of sovereignty should not be an absolute bar to intervention. However destabilizing U.S. counterterrorism legal theories are to the rule of law, they arose in response to real dilemmas, and it is not inconceivable that their very destabilizing qualities could ultimately help usher in a process of much-needed legal change. It wouldn't do to be Pollyanna-ish. The international order is a fragile one, and fragmentation, conflict, chaos, and collapse are just as likely. From a human rights perspective, too, any changes to the international order sparked by the U.S. war on terrorism are as likely to be for the worse as for the better. But it would be just as much a mistake to dismiss U.S. counterterrorism policy as the selfish, destructive flailing of an arrogant, damaged superpower. It is that, but not only that. Hegel famously defined tragedy as the conflict between two goods, each overly rigid in its claims. That's not a bad way to conceptualize the legal debates triggered by the war on terrorism. But the end of this drama is not yet written. Democracy and secret war. If I were a member of Congress right now, I would be hopping mad. Since September 11th, the United States has waged two very open wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, along with openly acknowledged airstrikes in Libya and Syria. But alongside these costly and visible wars, the United States has also been waging what amounts to a third secret war, waged mainly by drone strikes and special operations raids. We don't know what this secret war has cost us in dollars, and we don't know its cost in human lives either. But we can say with confidence that in addition to undermining international legal rules, the whole idea of a secret war is deeply offensive to core principles of American democracy, in particular to any notion of constitutional checks and balances. Our Constitution gives Congress vital powers relating to the use of military force. The power to declare war and the power to raise, support, and make rules regulating the armed forces and captures on land and water. Congress also has the constitutional power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, as well as the power to define and punish offenses against the law of nations. Yet the secret war, which began under President Bush and accelerated under President Obama, has gotten us very far away from anything Congress contemplated in the 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force, AUMF, passed just a few days after the September 11th attacks. For a document that has had such far-reaching consequences, the operative language of the 2001 AUMF is surprisingly short. It authorizes the president to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons, in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons. Look carefully at that language. It gives the executive branch authorization to use force, but note that it does not authorize the use of force against anyone, anywhere, anytime. Instead, it authorizes the use of force specifically and solely against those who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the September 11th attacks, or who harbored those who did. Furthermore, the AUMF authorizes force only for a specific purpose— to prevent future acts of terrorism against the United States by such organizations or states, not to prevent all future bad acts committed by anyone, anywhere. In fact, even in those terrifying days right after September 11th, when rescue personnel were still pulling corpses out of the wreckage of the Twin Towers and the west side of the Pentagon, Congress rejected a request from the Bush administration to pass a more expansive authorization to use military force. The administration initially asked that Congress authorize the use of force to deter and preempt any future acts of terrorism or aggression.
But even in that moment of grief, anger, and fear, Congress rejected such an open-ended AUMF, understanding full well that when Congress cedes power to the executive branch, it rarely comes back. For much of the last dozen years, despite international controversies, the 2001 AUMF provided adequate domestic legal authority both for the conflict in Afghanistan and for initial U.S. drone strikes outside hot battlefields. Most of the individuals targeted in early strikes were reportedly senior Taliban or Al-Qaeda operatives, putting them clearly in the category of targets contemplated by the AUMF. But this appears to have changed in the last few years as the threat has metastasized. As military action has decimated Al-Qaeda Central, U.S. drone strikes outside of hot battlefields have begun to target not only the remnants of core Al-Qaeda and Taliban, but also known or suspected members of other organizations. For the moment, leave aside the question of whether the expanding range of groups targeted by the United States all pose a genuine threat or the same degree of threat to the United States. Maybe these groups and individuals all pose a threat to the United States, and maybe they don't. Regardless, on its face, the 2001 AUMF just doesn't cover groups and individuals that were unconnected to the September 11th attacks. Obama administration lawyers have countered this argument by asserting that insofar as Congress intended the AUMF to be the functional equivalent of a declaration of war, the AUMF must be read to include the implied authority to target groups that are associated forces of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. However, it is far from clear that Congress actually did intend to authorize the use of force outside of traditional territorial battlefields against mere associates of those responsible for the September 11th attacks, particularly since many of those associated groups did not exist in 2001. In effect, the administration's assertion that the AUMF authorizes the use of force against Al-Qaeda's associated forces even outside of traditional battlefields appears to have become a backdoor way of expanding the AUMF far beyond Congress's intent. And to the extent that Congress accepts administration claims that force can be used against a broad category of persons and organizations determined, based on unknown criteria, to be Al-Qaeda associates, this effectively turns the AUMF into exactly the kind of open-ended authorization to use force that Congress rejected back in 2001. Call it AUMF mission creep. In recent years, the United States has targeted more and more people with no apparent connection to Al-Qaeda, no apparent connection to the September 11th attacks, and increasingly with no apparent connection to any imminent threat to the United States. Take the Al-Shabaab militants in Somalia targeted by drone strikes. I'm sure these were bad guys, and the world may be better off without them. Nonetheless, it's a huge stretch to shoehorn them into the 2001 AUMF. Even the Islamic State is, according to the U.S. government, covered by the AUMF. Since the groups share a common ancestry despite their current enmity, government lawyers have argued that the 2001 AUMF can be construed to authorize the use of force against the Islamic State. Saying that many recent U.S. drone strikes do not seem to fit well under the AUMF umbrella is not the same as saying that the president lacks any constitutional authority to use force in the absence of express congressional authorization. With or without an AUMF, the president unquestionably has the inherent constitutional power to use force against an imminent threat to the United States, no matter where and from whom it comes. Nonetheless, that is a power that U.S. presidents have, generally speaking, used rarely and for the most part wisely. The use of force without clear, ongoing congressional authorization should be the exception, not the norm. Ironically, President Obama seems to agree, at least some of the time. In 2013, he asserted that the 2001 AUMF is flawed and risks keeping America on a perpetual wartime footing, and he declared his intention to eventually repeal it. Despite this, he relied on it to justify the use of force against the Islamic State inside Syria. I'm sure his intentions are good. But good intentions notwithstanding, we now have a state of affairs in which our government, the government of a democratic nation that was founded on the premise that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, including the rights to life and liberty, is claiming for itself the power to kill any person anywhere on earth at any time without express congressional approval
based on information that is secret and has been collected and evaluated according to secret criteria by anonymous individuals in a secret procedure. Anyone who thinks this is consistent with American values should go back and reread the Declaration of Independence. The core notion of the rule of law is that all power must be constrained by law. Even the state must be accountable to those it acts upon. If we truly believe in the unalienable rights championed in the Declaration of Independence, human rights, we would call them today, the lack of transparency and accountability characterizing America's secret war should chill us to the bone. This is particularly true when we place the threat of terrorism into historical perspective. In the middle of the 19th century, the Civil War killed more than 600,000 Americans. Less than a century later, World War II killed more than 400,000 Americans. If you adjust for population size, these were horrific death tolls. And yet, even in the face of these existential threats, the United States didn't decide that we needed to give the executive branch wholesale authorization to use force against anyone, anywhere, anytime, permanently, without geographic or temporal limitations. Terrorism is a real threat, but keep it in perspective. We should be vigilant, particularly to ensure that terrorist groups don't gain access to weapons of mass destruction. But we should also keep in mind there has been no year except 2001 in which terrorism has killed more American citizens than lightning strikes. Do we really need to toss 200-plus years of American values out the window? A veritable catch-22. Don't count on the American court system to hold the executive branch accountable. The secret war and the paradoxes it creates are enough to make even judges dizzy. Every now and then, honest judges come right out and say so. In 2013, for instance, Judge Colleen McMahon of the Southern District of New York decided a case involving requests by the New York Times and the ACLU for government records relating to drone strikes against U.S. citizens, such as Anwar al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son, each killed in separate drone strikes in 2011. Judge McMahon began by acknowledging the legal complexities. There is and long has been robust debate about whether anti-terrorist operations in countries other than Afghanistan and adjacent territory in Pakistan can fairly or legally be classified as a war. However, even if there were no such debate, some Americans question the power of the executive to make a unilateral and unreviewable decision to kill an American citizen who is not actively engaged in armed combat operations against this country. As they gathered to draft a constitution, the founders, fresh from a war of independence from the rule of a king they styled a tyrant, were fearful of concentrating power. That concern was described by James Madison in Federalist No. 47, 1788. The accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, whether of one, a few, or many, and whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elective, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. Madison's statements echoed those of the great French philosopher Montesquieu, who wrote in his seminal work The Spirit of the Laws, 1748, "Were the power of judging joined to the executive power, the judge might behave with all the violence of an oppressor. There are thus, indeed, legitimate reasons to question the legality of killings unilaterally authorized by the executive that take place otherwise than on a hot field of battle." Judge McMahon made it clear that her substantive sympathies lay with those seeking greater transparency, noting that matters as important as the legal logic behind killing American citizens should not be kept secret from the citizenry itself. In the end, however, she ruled against the request for information made by the New York Times and the ACLU. Regardless of her views of the underlying issues, she acknowledged the government's refusal to release the records appeared to be in accordance with the laws governing classified materials. "I can only conclude that the government cannot be compelled by this court of law to explain in detail the reasons why its actions do not violate the Constitution and laws of the United States." The Alice in Wonderland nature of this pronouncement is not lost on me, but I find myself stuck in a paradoxical situation, a veritable catch-22. I can find no way around the thicket of laws and precedents that effectively allow the executive branch of our government to proclaim as perfectly lawful certain actions that seem on their face incompatible with our Constitution and laws, while keeping the reasons for their conclusion a secret. Trickle-down war. The history of the Western nation-state is intimately entwined with the history of war. The state makes war both in the traditional sense of waging war and in the linguistic and legal senses. And when the state makes war in any of these ways, the shape of the state may itself begin to change. World War II transformed Western states profoundly, ushering in the era of the regulatory welfare state. More recently, the War on Terror, or if you prefer, the armed conflict with Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, has begun to transform the state in new ways. In the United States, it has led the state to invest in technologies to help it track and kill these enemies across the globe. This investment has driven a vast growth in the military, security, corporate complex, as thousands of new firms have sprung up to help the government make war. These include private military and security companies, such as the former Blackwater and Triple Canopy, as well as consulting firms that collect and analyze intelligence data, design cyber defenses, create training materials for the military, or develop sophisticated nanobots. At the same time, the increased use of these new technological capabilities is changing the United States' relationship with other states, altering previously held ideas of sovereignty. The war on terrorism is also altering the relationship between individuals and the state. After 9/11, human rights advocates and civil libertarians were quick to point out the ways in which laws and policies purportedly necessary to the war on terrorism have increased state power at the expense of transparency, accountability, and individual rights. After 9/11, the USA Patriot Act and similar legislation greatly enhanced the state's domestic search and seizure powers in national security-related cases, for instance. Most of these post-9/11 state activities have been authorized by Congress and have been largely upheld, or at least tolerated, by the courts. But what is less well known is the way in which the war on terrorism is also transforming our courtrooms, police departments, and immigration services. Many of the U.S. practices and legal doctrines developed after 9/11 for war-making purposes are trickling down, subtly but perniciously, into ordinary law and law enforcement. Domestic policing. You can see it most obviously in domestic policing. The trend toward increased militarization of U.S. police predates 9/11, but accelerated after the attacks. The first police SWAT teams, for instance, were created after the 1965 Watts riots in Los Angeles. Initially, they were used primarily for emergencies such as hostage situations and domestic terror threats. Over time, however, the number of SWAT teams expanded, and such teams were increasingly used in routine policing, deployed to execute search and arrest warrants in drug-related cases, for instance. There were an estimated 3,000 SWAT raids nationwide in 1980. By 2006, the number of annual SWAT raids had jumped to 50,000, and by 2012, there were as many as 80,000 SWAT raids per year. The increased use of SWAT teams has been paralleled by a similar post-9/11 rise in police efforts to adopt other tactics developed by foreign militaries and intelligence services for counterterrorism purposes. The proliferation of police academy programs modeled on military basic training, the increased use of military-style battle dress uniforms for police on the streets, and the growing use by police departments of weapons and other equipment developed for military purposes, from Humvees to surveillance drones. Many of these weapons and equipment literally come direct from foreign war zones through a Defense Department program that donates unneeded military equipment to police forces. Homeland Security counterterrorism grants have also fueled the police acquisition of tools more commonly associated with war. Increasingly, war and policing have begun to converge both in terms of tactics and in terms of outward appearance. As legal scholar John Perry has noted, war has changed in its functions to become more like policing, and policing too has changed to become more like war. On the covert battlefields of the war on terrorism, outside of Iraq and Afghanistan, U.S. war-making often superficially resembles policing in that it involves individuals and small teams rather than the large-scale armies associated with 19th and 20th century warfare. And its victories and defeats are defined in terms of the activities of individuals and organizations rather than in terms of terrain held or surrendered. As police departments increasingly use military tactics, weapons, equipment, and even apparel, domestic policing has come to look more and more like war. Secrecy in the courtroom. In America's courtrooms, the effects of 9/11 are also apparent when judges confront the promiscuous use of the so-called state secrets privilege. The state secrets privilege is meant to prevent secrets damaging to national security interests from being released during a court case. If government officials fear that classified information might be revealed during litigation, they can ask the judge to block the release of that information or even dismiss a lawsuit altogether. Technically, courts have the power to reject government claims of state secrets and release the information anyway, but judges are generally reluctant to do so and tend to defer to executive branch requests. Examining docket records from the past 30 years and records from the more than 1,300 case holdings since 1790 that refer to state secrets, Georgetown's Laura Donahue found that the state secrets privilege has increasingly been invoked by private litigants in cases relating to breach of contract, patient disputes, trade secrets, fraud, and employment termination, wrongful death, personal injury, and negligence. On the surface, these are cases that have nothing at all to do with national security, but the expansive war on terrorism has led to increased interpenetration of the government and the private sector, with government agencies relying on private companies to provide a range of support services. Similarly, the government's desire to access information such as private internet records has led to complex and generally secret new relationships among the military, the intelligence community, and private telecom and internet companies. As a result, more and more private actors are in possession of government secrets, increasing the number of cases with no surface connection to national security in which private actors might nonetheless have to disclose classified information in the course of routine litigation. Donahue also noted the rise of a form of gray mail, in which corporations that possess sensitive information as a result of government contracts seek to pressure the government to intervene in private litigation by suggesting that unless the government invokes the state secrets doctrine, they may be forced to reveal state secrets in order to defend themselves. Such subtle threats create incentives for government intervention. Even when the government declines to intervene or when courts ultimately reject state secrets claims, efforts to invoke the state secrets doctrine can delay cases or force their removal to federal courts. In recent years, Donahue concluded, the state secrets doctrine has evolved into a powerful litigation tool wielded by both private and public actors. It has been used to undermine contractual obligations and to pervert tort law, creating a form of private indemnity for government contractors in a broad range of areas. In the context of criminal prosecutions, parallel dangers are raised by the Classified Information Procedures Act, CIPA. Under CIPA, the government can make an in-camera ex parte submission to the court, that is, a secret submission made without the knowledge of the other party to the litigation, asking the court to delete specified items of classified information from documents to be made available to the defendant. CIPA is not new, but in the post-9/11 context, it has a newly worrisome impact. The government has been classifying documents at an unprecedented pace, and an ever-growing number of private companies have become involved in the production and use of classified information. As the sheer quantity and range of classified information increases, and the number of private companies privy to classified information goes up, we can expect an increase in the number of ordinary criminal cases that touch upon classified national security information in a purely ancillary way. That means we can also expect an increase in the number of cases in which defendants may be deprived of the ability to use or even find out about information that might help their case. The impact of secret evidence upon the adversary system has yet to be acknowledged, argues law scholar Ellen Yaroshevsky, in large measure because of the unstated belief that CIPA is confined to a narrow range of terrorism cases. But, she asserts, secret evidence is seeping into the criminal justice system as a result of overclassification, the growing number of individuals and companies involved in classified activities, and the tendency of prosecutors to overcharge ordinary crimes under anti-terrorism statutes. Immigration. Since 9/11, U.S. immigration law and policy have also become deeply bound up with counter-terrorism efforts. The 9/11 attackers were all foreigners, and the apparent ease with which they entered the United States raised obvious questions about the adequacy of U.S. border control methods and screening programs. After 9/11, the Immigration and Naturalization Service was relocated into the newly created Department of Homeland Security and reorganized. Most of its responsibilities shifted to DHS's new Immigration and Customs Enforcement Division, ICE. The name change itself signaled a shift away from a service model to an enforcement model. There has been an enormous post-9/11 increase in funding for immigration programs with connections to Homeland Security. In particular, as a 2011 Migration Policy Institute report documents, the post-9/11 era has given rise to unprecedented information collection and sharing between intelligence agencies, law enforcement agencies, and immigration agencies. The original purpose of this extensive data collection, including the collection of biometric data, was to identify those with connections to Al-Qaeda and prevent additional terrorist attacks. Numerous government organizations gather information, including fingerprints, from resident aliens and foreigners seeking entry into the United States at airports and land borders. At least in theory, the ability to cross-check such information with that gathered by intelligence and law enforcement agencies can enable officials to prevent potential terrorist plotters from gaining entry into the United States and trace connections between foreign nationals already inside the United States and foreign terrorist organizations. But though only a tiny fraction of immigrants and foreign visitors have any link to terrorism, such extensive data collection and information sharing has become the norm for all immigrant groups and most foreign travelers to the United States. This has costs. It has led to huge post-9/11 increase in the number of annual immigrant detentions and deportations, as an information collection system designed to identify violent terrorists has been used to snag even those immigrants with only trivial criminal histories. A teen shoplifting incident, for instance, is more than enough to lead to deportation. Information sharing between intelligence agencies and ICE has also led to increased scrutiny of immigrants from particular countries, ethnic groups, and religious backgrounds, leading to unequal enforcement of immigration laws. It is impossible to say whether these changes have reduced the risk of terrorism. What does seem clear, however, is that they have made individual immigrants and foreign nationals, particularly those from Middle Eastern or Islamic backgrounds, far more vulnerable to various forms of surveillance, detention, and removal. As the threat of homegrown Islamic extremist terrorism increases, these immigrant and foreign-born communities are among those with which law enforcement officials most need friendly relations. But the increased threat of deportation has left many immigrants more fearful than ever of contact with local or federal authorities. Privacy and surveillance. The war on terrorism has led the U.S. government to dramatically step up its efforts to collect and analyze an extraordinarily wide range of information, from cell phone metadata and internet communications to biometric data, such as fingerprints, DNA, and retina scans. The government can now use facial recognition software, for instance, to track a person by sifting through countless images provided by social media or surveillance cameras. Technological leaps like these have made it possible to identify enemies through pattern analysis, even when there is no specific information linking them to hostile activities. This has led to an increase in so-called signature strikes, drone strikes against unidentified people presumed to be targetable enemies because of their communications patterns and travel patterns. The post-9/11 USA Patriot Act effectively eliminated the pre-9/11 firewall between foreign intelligence gathering and domestic law enforcement. Today, law enforcement officials can access a wide range of sensitive information, including internet records, telephone metadata, library records, and credit and banking information of U.S. citizens, as long as they can show reasonable grounds to believe that the tangible things sought are relevant to an authorized investigation, to obtain foreign intelligence information not concerning a United States person, or to protect against international terrorism or clandestine intelligence activities. This has benefits, but it's also easy to imagine information gained in this manner, say evidence of extramarital affairs or psychiatric treatment, being repurposed by law enforcement officials to put pressure on potential witnesses or informants in non-terrorism-related cases. Similarly, the sophisticated pattern recognition technologies originally developed for military and intelligence purposes can also easily be used by domestic law enforcement officials. Imagine, for instance, the police use of drone-based imaging technologies such as the military's Gorgon Stare, a platform that permits the visualization and videotaping of whole neighborhoods. Police will soon have the ability to use such technologies to track the movements and communications of thousands of people, searching for those whose travel patterns suggest links to gang activity. The trouble is, these powerful new technologies can also introduce powerful new errors, leading to faulty guilt-by-association assumptions. Say pattern recognition technologies determine that the same unidentified man is repeatedly driving to, from, and between the houses of known gang members, or telephone metadata indicate frequent calls between the man and the known gang members. The data might be assumed to indicate that the unidentified man is part of a criminal network, but in reality, he might simply be the pizza delivery guy. Beyond this, widespread surveillance and government access to personal data can have obvious chilling effects on the exercise on constitutionally protected rights. Consider, for instance, the impact on journalists who must rely heavily on information provided confidentially by sources. Some of our longtime trusted sources have become nervous and anxious about talking to us, even on stories that aren't about national security, Associated Press President Gary Pruitt commented in a 2013 speech. And in some cases, government employees that we once checked in with regularly will no longer speak to us by phone, and some are reluctant to meet in person. Trickle-down is inherently difficult to discern and measure, and the problem is exacerbated by government secrecy. But it's past time to look at this phenomenon more comprehensively. Given the huge effects these changes could have on our country and our lives, can we afford not to? Chapter 19. Institutional Costs. Civil-military paradoxes. The blurring lines between war and peace also have costs for the U.S. military, and the relations between the military and civil society. Civil-military relations in modern America have come to be characterized more by paradox than by consistency. Ordinary Americans support the military more than ever, but know less about it than ever. Meanwhile, elite Washington policymakers simultaneously overestimate the military's capabilities and mistrust the military leadership. We view our military as the strongest military in the history of the world, even as conventional military tools have less and less value. We no longer know what kind of military we need, or how to distinguish between civilian and military tasks and roles. And although today's military is better educated and more professional than ever, its internal structures, from recruiting and training to personnel policies, still lag badly behind those in most civilian workplaces. All this adds up to a recipe for tensions between civilian and military leaders, challenges to military morale, and in the end, poor policy decisions. Civilian-military gaps matter, but not in the ways we usually think. Lying beneath the more superficial civilian-military knowledge and opinion gaps reflected in public polls is a less obvious but more pernicious gap between elite civilian political leaders and elite military leaders, a gap of knowledge and a gap of trust. I'm speaking here not of elites as defined in public opinion polls, but of the tiny decision-making elite that runs the nation's capital. The few hundred people, certainly less than 1,000 people, who occupy senior positions in the White House's West Wing, the old Executive Office Building, the State Department's 7th floor, and the Pentagon's E-ring. This elite group includes the service chiefs and their senior deputies, the president's top national security staff, the cabinet secretaries, and their senior deputies. In Washington speak, it's the principals and the deputies, together with a handful of influential advisors with outline positions. If there's any venue where civilians and military personnel work together side by side, day after day, it's in Washington's national security establishment. In theory, this constant interaction ought to breed respect and mutual understanding. In practice, it often produces the opposite, a mixture of suspicion and almost willful ignorance. In Washington, many top civilian policymakers want the military to do anything and everything, but only when told to do so. They imagine that military power can be used to solve virtually any problem and are baffled when military leaders take a more conservative approach. At the same time, they want military leaders to execute policy rather than making policy,
making them suspicious of anything they view as military efforts to constrain or influence civilian policy decisions. Too frequently, the favor is returned by military leaders who mistrust civilians as politicians and are sometimes unwilling to accept their concerns as legitimate. Military leaders are often all too eager to stay in the narrowest of lanes, not understanding that this can be viewed as obstructionism by civilians searching for options and ideas. From the military perspective, civilian leaders constantly ask for the impossible, then get annoyed when the impossibilities are pointed out. Too many senior civilian officials know virtually nothing about the structure of military organizations, the chain of command, or the military planning process, while some senior military officers have forgotten that there's any other way to run an organization or think about problem solving. Most fundamentally, civilian and military leaders often think of themselves and their roles in quite different ways, though the differences are generally unarticulated.